You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Edgar B. Herwick III. It is the first Friday of the month, and that means we're going to hitch the BPR cart to Sky and Telescope Magazine's Kelly Beatty for a trip into the stars. We're going to take a look ahead at what's going to happen up there in outer space this month. Kelly Beatty, of course, senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope Magazine, and he's with me right now in the studio.
Hey,
doing,
Edgar.
Kelly? It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
So before we look ahead, today, when you're talking about outer space, is a sad day and a day for looking back a little bit. Today is the 10th anniversary of the Columbia shuttle disaster, which is probably between the two big shuttle disasters, the Challenger and the Columbia. That's the one that I think people think about less. It didn't have the dramatic impact that the 86 Challenger disaster did. Real quick, I want to listen to a little bit of sound from that day. We're going to go 10 years ago today. George Bush was president, and this is how he told the nation about what happened that morning.
My fellow Americans, this day has brought terrible news and great sadness to our country. At 9 o'clock this morning, Mission Control in Houston lost contact with our space shuttle Columbia. A short time later, debris was seen falling from the skies above Texas. The Columbia is lost. There are no survivors.
It just sort of really underscores how dangerous the proposition of going into space really is, and I think that's something a lot of people forget.
They certainly do, and you know, it's a situation that is seared in our memory. I remember that morning.
Yeah.
This crew was 16 minutes from landing. You know, they were all strapped in. They were just sort of enjoying the ride coming back, and we now know that it had everything to do with a problem at the launch.
And yeah.
You know, we think of space travel as routine, but it is always dangerous.
Yeah.
It is always dangerous. And NASA has tried mightily over these many decades to try to reduce the risk of loss, but the risk never goes away.
Yeah.
In our program or anybody else's program. This day of remembrance is not only for the crew of Columbia, but also of Challenger, for the crew of, you know, Apollo 1 at the beginning of our moon mission.
All right, and that was, they never even left. That was a fire that happened
on the launch pad.
On the launch pad.
On
right?
the launch yeah. pad. And you know, there have been Russian cosmonauts who have died coming back too. So it, in the grand scheme of things, on a percentage basis, it's been pretty safe. But these things, when they happen, boy, they are truly spectacular.
Yeah. So, you know, you talk about the risk of going into outer space, and certainly people, you know, an individual person can decide to take a risk if they want to, but writ large, you know, have the gains from what man has done going into space made it worth the risks? I mean, is it, have we learned things that have made it worth the dangers of sending human beings into space?
That's a two-edged sword, really.
Yeah.
So in the early days of space exploration, up until, say, I would say maybe the mid-70s,
mm-hmm.
it was a grand adventure. We went to the moon. We conquered our fears. We harnessed technology. We showed that we had the right stuff. And it was a rallying point for the entire nation. Our technological prowess, you know, was really enhanced by that. Since that time, people who follow this stuff would say, well, look, we've just kept going around and around and around the Earth. Mm. And when you put forward an idea like, let's go build a moon base, right?
Yeah.
Somebody of, you know, a younger age would say, well, why should we do what my grandparents did? Why just do that again?
It's old stuff.
Right. Now, President Obama has put forward a proposal to send astronauts out to an asteroid, which mm-hmm. I think would be very cool, and ultimately to the planet Mars. Again, the threshold's been set high. There is a reason to do it. The problem is that the political and financial will isn't there right now. So I think this is going to be a very long time coming, with the possible exception of the Chinese space program, which is really in high gear, and they are the competition right now.
Yeah.
And so we'll see what happens.
Do you think that they become a foil like the Russians did for us during the 60s in the lead up to getting on the moon? I mean, do you think that there's, I mean, we've heard about John Kerry talking about American exceptionalism, right? And like, you know, if China does begin to advance, does that change the will here in the United States to say, well, wait a minute, we're still the greatest country on Earth. We can still do this. Or is space exploration something we're just ready to seed?
I don't think it's something we're ready to seed. But I think it's something we're perhaps willing to share.
Mm.
And so even now, the biggest space programs. Take the International Space Station, for example. You know, we think of it as an American thing,
yeah,
but there are Russian modules, there are Italian modules, Japanese, European Space Agency. There's a whole range of pieces that came together because no one nation could afford to do the whole thing. Mm. And I think that's what we might see if we ever had the desire, strong desire, to go to Mars. It would be an international mission.
Which could be pretty great. Now, Kelly Beatty, you just mentioned asteroids. I want to talk about asteroids because when we're looking now ahead at the month of February, big sort of highlighted moment, middle of the month, we're going to have a near-Earth asteroid, and it's a little bit different than most near-Earth asteroids have been. Isn't that right?
Yeah, the watchword is duck, because on the 15th, we have an asteroid that's going to come within 18,000 miles of the Earth's surface. Now, that sounds like a long ways away, but most of our communications and weather satellites are actually farther away. So it's coming close. There's no danger it will hit.
How come there's no danger? We know with certainty.
We know with certainty that it is, you know, nothing is going to change its course, and its course is going to pass by safely. This rock, which has the sort of alphanumeric soup full of
one
names.
Of these
2012 DA14, for those who are keeping score at home.
Again, I'm just going to urge the space agencies the world over to get your marketing department in high gear here, because 2012 DA14's mouthful.
Edgar, be nice to me, because asteroids can be named for people.
Really?
But yeah, so if someone discovers an asteroid, it could be named, you know, Herwick.
So
don't burn your bridges.
Okay, good call.
This is just a temporary designation, all right? It was discovered last year. It's about the size of like a high school gym.
Okay.
And so if it hit, you know, it would cause a lot of damage, and so it bears watching. But from this point of view, this month's February 15th, when it comes closest by, it's really kind of a nice thing for amateur astronomers and professionals around the world to watch go by. Mm. That's really what's involved.
So how are people going to watch this? Like, take us inside. Like, will there be people in observatories, people in backyards with telescopes? You're going to be able to see it? Is it moving by fast? Like, how does it work?
Yes, yes, and yes.
All right.
The only downside is when it is closest, it will be moving almost a degree per minute across the sky. It's really going to be moving fast. Mm. But that's going to happen on the other side of the world from us. It'll be daytime here when it comes by fast.
Okay.
So once it turns night on the 15th, it will already have passed by and will be visible. And you'll need a really good telescope and exact coordinates for it. So I'm not going to try to coax people into seeing it.
Yeah, yeah.
At the Clay Center Observatory, where I teach, we will be tracking the asteroid as it goes by. So if you go to claycenter.org on that night, you might see a little live video feed of us watching it.
That's cool. Is there anything to be learned from this asteroid passing by besides it's kind of a neat thing and it's going to happen? Is there any sort of science that we're going to take away from this?
Sure, absolutely. So these objects are all over the inner solar system, and they occasionally do hit the Earth. They hit the Moon. The Moon's all full of craters.
Yeah.
The Earth used to be full of craters, too, but they all got eroded away. And they do hit every now and then. Smaller ones hit more often. The great big ones, you know, the kind that wipe out the dinosaurs, fortunately don't hit but every 100 million years or so.
Yeah.
One of the things we really want to know is, are they one solid piece of rock, or are they a pile of boulders just sort of put together? That would affect how we approach trying to protect ourselves from it. And so as this one goes by, we're going to be watching it carefully to see if we can pick up on its surface characteristics.
Very interesting stuff. I'm talking with Kelly Beatty. He's senior contributing editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. It is the first Friday, and we're looking ahead at the month of February in the skies, in the stars. I'm going to get back to Kelly in a second, but we did tell you we were going to keep an eye on what's happening and that we were anticipating that former Republican Senator Scott Brown was going to make some sort of announcement today. That has come, according to an AP source. Republican Scott Brown will not run in a special election for John Kerry's Massachusetts Senate seat. So just to say that again, according to the AP right now, Republican Scott Brown will not run in a special election for Kerry's Massachusetts Senate seat. That's from the AP. And there you have it. So serious political stuff, serious political news right there, Kelly.
Political stars, as it were.
All right. So we took it back down to Earth for a minute. Let's go back up into the skies. You know, you were just saying, we were talking about this asteroid. What is this asteroid made of, this particular one?
It's rocky.
It's just rock.
A giant overgrown, you know, rock from outer space. It's a space rock. What
space
can
rock.
I say?
All right. But now not all asteroids are made of the same stuff, right? I mean, asteroids, different rocks, different minerals. And this is something that is starting to get the attention of people here on Earth. You know, the idea being that, all right, well, there's a whole bunch of asteroids up there. Some of them have things like gold on them. Some of the things have, you know, things that we need, platinum, stuff that we need here, which we know is in limited supply here on Earth. So recently, there's been a lot more attention starting to be turned and paid to this idea of maybe somehow being able to harness these metals on these asteroids.
Right, absolutely. And water that they might contain, too, which is almost as precious as the metal inside. You know, these rocks that come by the Earth are from a how big a rocket do I need point of view, very low energy to reach. So that's why we can imagine sending astronauts to an asteroid sooner than we might send them even back to the moon.
Yeah.
Right? So there are now three different companies that have announced a plan to basically lasso these things and mine them for the metals, platinum group metals, and the water that they contain. And that could be, you know, $1 trillion industry in the not-too-distant future. And so there's a lot of money to be made. The business model looks good. Part of the problem is that we don't know where they all are. And so one step in making that business model fly is that first thing you need to do is find out where they all are so that you can hitch up to one as it goes by.
So we have different companies who are going to kind of have some different approaches here. I think the one that's gotten the most attention is Planetary Resources. That's
yes.
the name of this one. And I think one of the reasons why they're getting this amount of attention is because Larry Page from Google's involved in this. He's a backer. So is James Cameron, the filmmaker,
right.
the guy behind Titanic and The Abyss. So certainly somebody who that sort of matches up with our idea of who James Cameron is, right?
This right.
He loves stories about exploration, so he's throwing some money behind this. Now, their idea is that they want to launch orbiting telescopes that are going to identify asteroids. That's kind of one approach.
That's
right?
the first step. No, that's just the first step. As I said, you need to find them before you can go visit them.
Yep.
And every one of these three has that as sort of the first step.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm not real a big booster of the Planetary Resources scheme. Their idea is to create hundreds and hundreds of these satellites, launch them like bang, 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 bang.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them are going to fail, but that's okay. They're going to have so many of them that it won't matter.
So they're just going with a pure numbers
shotgun
game.
Shotgun
approach. Yeah, we're just going to use as many as we can.
And they haven't really thought through. You know, you discover one of these things zipping by, and you can't just say, oh, I just saw an asteroid go by. You need to know exactly where it was at what time so that you can recover it and determine what its orbit is.
Mm.
That's not really in the Planetary Resources game plan. These other companies have, a more robust, at least in terms of detection, they have a more robust approach to how they're going to do it.
Deep Space Industries and their marketing department is working in high gear because they're saying that they're going to create these spacecraft, you know, so maybe satellites as well, but they're calling them spacecraft called Fireflies, these little guys, which is great, right?
Yeah.
And then hopefully some bigger ones, which they're going to call Dragonflies, and they're going to go out and they're going to try to find asteroids.
Right. I think the one to watch is a company called the B612 Foundation.
All right. The B612 Foundation.
Right. And that was the asteroid name in the children's book, The Little Prince.
Oh, cool.
And I think they have the most robust scheme going forward. They may not have the big name backers, but mm-hmm. I think their plan is pretty sound.
How does their plan differ? Is it just they have more steps kind of sketched out, or
they are using rather than invent a spacecraft from scratch, which is what Planetary Resources is going to do, they're going to use existing designs for pretty robust orbiting telescopes and that are well characterized. You need big optics in order to spot these things. They're tiny, tiny, faint things.
Yeah.
And so I think the B612 group has the horsepower, the brain trust, if you will, to really make it work. At least what I've seen on paper so far. We'll see. We'll see who attracts the most money and take it from there.
Ultimately, do you think this is a good idea and even potentially a necessary idea? I mean, just the pure math of the situation says eventually with humans on this planet, we're going to run out of stuff. One of two things has to happen, right? Either we got to find ways to do things that doesn't need the stuff, like gold, or we're going to have to find more of it. So,
well, I think the short answer is the most powerful outcome of this will simply be knowing where all of these asteroids are so that we could know in advance, be it, you know, 2 years, 20 years, whatever, that one is coming at us and we need to do something to change its course or it will hit.
All right, I'm talking with Kelly Beatty. He is the senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Before we get to what's going to be happening in the stars over the next couple weeks that we can see in our backyards, et cetera, I want to stay on this idea of drilling because the Mars rover Curiosity, which is still plugging along up there, you know, it's up there in Mars, they're this week going to be doing something which has never been done before, which is drill into Mars.
That's right. They're going to be drilling into a rock. Let's step back a step. This rover, Curiosity, is the size of a small car, Mini Cooper-ish.
And my 2000 Toyota Echo.
Right. And it's got a power pack on it that's fueled by radioactive plutonium. So it keeps itself warm at night. It doesn't need to have solar panels to gather sunlight. It's a brute, all right, as rovers go. And it's equipped with a drill to get through the sort of surface coating on these Mars rocks and actually get down in and see what's there. You have to remember, it landed last August, and its mission is 2 years long. It's not 3 months like the earlier rovers have been. It's in it for the long haul, and all of this stuff, including the drilling this coming week, are just preliminaries. The real goal, the Holy Grail, is to climb up the slopes of a mountain that it landed next to, which has layers in it, and those layers were set down in time. The ones at the bottom were set down longest ago, maybe 3 billion years ago, and the ones closer to the top were more recent. At some point in its past, Mars went from being a warmer, wetter planet to one that's just brutally cold and dry. And we need to know when that transition took place and why it took place. And Curiosity gives us our best shot at that.
That's really interesting. So right now, the drilling that it's going to do is in this area of rocks, which are called John Klein. Do you know, I cannot seem to find out why they call this outcropping of rocks John Klein.
Well, they name them, I'm going to have to draw a blank here, but they name them after people who have worked at JPL.
Yeah.
Some of them have been former Mars rover drivers who might be dead now.
Yeah.
And it's just a way to keep track of everything. You know, those things don't come with, they're not on Google Maps,
right?
when you land. So they have to sort of establish their own waypoints. But these rocks are some sort of sediment, and this will give the rover and its many instruments a lot of good practice for the main event, which should be 3 or 4 months down the road. So think of this as just learning how to walk for the rover, or learning how to drill in this case, and something it's going to need a lot of in the months ahead.
Very cool. So looking into the skies, going from Mars to another planet, Jupiter, still dominating the evening skies right now, right?
It is. When it gets dark at night, if you look up almost overhead, you'll see an incredibly bright star. That is not a star. That is the planet Jupiter. Jupiter is the biggest planet in our solar system. It reflects a lot of sunlight back toward the Earth, so it makes it really bright and obvious. And it has been there. We've talked about it for the last couple of months, and it will remain in the evening sky for another couple of months. If you watch it week by week, month by month, it will start edging closer and closer to the sunset point. So they'll come, in 4 or 5 months, we won't be able to see it anymore. But for the time being, it's great. If you've got a pair of binoculars or a small telescope, Jupiter's a terrific target. But I do want to call people's attention to another planet that is hard to see, and you can really, you know, this is a notch on your sky-gazing gun belt. The planet Mercury is going to be making its best appearance, if probably for the whole year, this coming month, during February. You know, if you can imagine a summertime scene with a light bulb outside and bugs flying around it.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Sometimes a bug is on one side or the other, but it's always close to the light bulb.
Yeah.
Same way with Mercury. It's the innermost planet. It's never far from the sun, at least as we see it in the sky. So it takes a special circumstance to see it. So here's what I want folks to do. The second or third week of February, centered around like the 15th, 16th, about the time the asteroid's going by, watch where the sun sets, and 45 minutes later, look in that same spot about 10 degrees above the horizon. And 10 degrees is your fist at arm's length stretched out. Right?
Okay.
That's about 10 degrees
wide. We're
both
doing it in the studio here.
Right. And you'll see a bright, you need a really clear view toward the west for this to work.
Okay.
And you'll see a bright star lingering there in the twilight, and that is the planet Mercury.
Cool.
And that is one that's really hard to spot, and you can be proud of yourself for doing it.
What does Mercury look like? I mean, generally, like...
Interesting you should ask that question. Mercury is about half the size of the Earth. Through a telescope, it would just look like a small white dot.
Yeah.
Most of the telescopes we have. Even really good ones don't do a very good job of it. Right now, we have a spacecraft in orbit around it called MESSENGER around Mercury. And it discovered, just within the past few months, that, believe it or not, in the polar regions of Mercury, where the sun never shines because of deep craters, there is ice, deposits of ice.
Water ice?
Water ice. These are literally snowballs in hell. And because the planet itself otherwise is hundreds of degrees. It's very close to the sun and quite hot. But in these shadowed regions, it's incredibly cold. And so when a comet hits Mercury, for example, creates this big splash, some of that water migrates to the polar regions and freezes out, just like your tongue on a cold flagpole. And so that water ice stays there. And the Messenger spacecraft has discovered that it is there. It's really there.
That's kind of shocking. Was that a surprise to scientists, or did they sort of postulate that that would be the case?
It was predicted. From Earth, we can ping the planet Mercury with radar, and we get a really strong echo from the polar regions. There's no reason for that to happen except for the existence of ice there. Water ice would do that. The other news I got to tell you about, and this just broken within the last couple of days.
Cool. Apparently,
meteorite collectors have come across a meteorite found in Morocco about this time last year that might be from the planet Mercury, the first time ever. We've got most meteorites are from the asteroid belt.
Yep. Right?
Those are space rocks. There are a few dozen that we know of that are from the moon. They've blasted off the surface of the moon. They've landed on Earth. Mm-hmm. Ditto for Mars. Mm-hmm. The ones from Mercury were predicted, but
We've
yet to come across one. Thanks to MESSENGER, we know what the surface of Mercury should be like compositionally.
Okay.
And this meteorite, which has one of those funny names, NWA7325.
That's a good one, though. I like that one.
All right. That stands for Northwest Africa, Morocco, which is where it was found.
Yeah.
Seems to have all the compositional ducks in a row that are making it's causing quite an excitement among the scientists right now.
When do you think we'll know for sure? Like what kind of testing still has to be done to sort of give it the check mark and say, yes, that is a piece of Mercury?
It could never be an absolute.
Okay.
For right now and for the foreseeable future is going to be a, you know, best case scenario here. The thing is that we wouldn't even know this except for the fact that MESSENGER is around Mercury and telling us tons about this planet, which is otherwise very hard to see. So we know, for example, that the surface of Mercury is covered with lava flows that have very little iron in them.
Mm.
All right, this is unusual for the Earth, and it's a very unusual kind of rock, but that's what this meteorite is. It's an igneous rock.
Mm-hmm.
It cooled from lava, and it has virtually no iron in it.
Wow.
And so, you know, everything seems to match up pretty well.
Oh, I'm talking with Kelly Beattie. He is the senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. Now, Kelly, I think we have a picture up on our Facebook page of your tie today, which has some constellations on it, which is, you know, very good choice for somebody in your field. One of the constellations that is looming large right now in the dark is Orion.
Orion the Hunter.
So how and where do we spot Orion? And tell us a little bit about Orion before I let you go here.
Okay,
today.
Orion is sort of the prototypical constellation for winter. It's a wintertime constellation. Mm-hmm. It looms large. When the sun goes down, it's well up in the east. Just turn around opposite where the sun sets. You'll see it. You'll know Orion because it's got three bright stars in a row, very mm-hmm. close together, that make his belt in mythology.
Right.
You know, in mythology, Orion was a great hunter. And so he's got a really bright star above that belt in his armpit region where he would be mythologically. That's Betelgeuse. Some people say Betelgeuse.
Betelgeuse, Betelgeuse, Betelgeuse.
Betelgeuse, right.
Some people say Michael Keaton.
There is no star named for Michael Keaton.
This is now my mission. I am going to try to get a star named after Michael Keaton because that guy is a star in my book.
And then below the belt is an equally bright star marking Orion's knee, which is called Rigel.
Okay.
Now, Rigel is a blue-white star, and Betelgeuse is a red supergiant. So if you look at those two stars carefully, you might get a sense that they're slightly different colors.
Hmm.
Stars have colors. We'll get into this next time, maybe. Stars have different colors because they're at different temperatures. And we think of red as hot.
Yeah.
But as stars go, red are the cooler stars. Blue, white are the hottest ones. And you know this in your head because the flame from your gas grill is a much hotter flame than from a candle. And that's a blue flame versus a yellow one.
There it is. We'll talk. Oh, that's great. We'll talk a little bit more about that next time when we look ahead to the skies in the beginning of March. But for now, we are out of time with you, Kelly Beattie, senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. Thanks for taking us up into the stars.
Hey, my pleasure, Edgar. Till next time.
Yeah. So before we come back to Earth with Callie Crossley here, I do just want to mention, when you hear this song, I'm sure what you think of is 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is the Stanley Kubrick film. And this month at the MFA, Stanley Kubrick's entire career, basically, is being celebrated. His films are going to be showing, including 2001 and the ones that you know about, like A Clockwork Orange, Dr. Strangelove, but also some of his early works. We're going to be talking, hopefully, about that later in the month, but I wanted to let people know this is going on at the MFA all month before we're able to get to it in a few weeks when we talk about it in a segment here. So check that out. We'll have links on our website. And now we'll bring it back to Earth here, Callie Crossley.
Hi, Edgar.
How you doing?
I'm down to Earth with my down to Earth panel from local around this time. We're looking under the radar stories regionally, locally.
Anything good?
Yeah. A kid made a gun out of a Lego. And,
out of Legos?
Yes. It turns out there's a...
Like a working gun?
No.
Oh, he just like made
a gun. How do
you
make a working gun out of a Lego?
And there's a law against him doing this.
And he's a kindergartner, yes.
Did he get in trouble?
Yes, it's a big kerfuffle. We'll
That's
talk
crazy.
About it.
All right. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III.
And I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.